The Tom Woods Show, episode 2162.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We've got rather an unusual but yet very interesting topic today, and that has to do with the economics of ambulance services. This is one of these topics you might be inclined to overlook, but yet again, the state is involved in ways you're not even aware of to make your life worse. And joining me to talk about it is Nick Paprosky, who is chief operating officer of a large EMS staffing company. He's also a licensed paramedic himself and still practices as a paramedic. And he's got nearly 20 years experience under his belt. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I think this is one of these cases where only an industry insider would really know what you know about what the problems are and how much they have to do with state regulation. And so this is another area where the average person is having his life made worse for reasons he can't identify. And of course, if he even does pause to think about why it's being made worse, he'll blame the wrong people, the wrong reasons. I think this is pervasive. There are so many ways the state impoverishes us or makes our lives more difficult, but we don't know the ins and outs of, you know, how many people are going to know the ins and outs of what goes on with ambulances? Almost nobody. So they're not even going to know that their lives could be better. This service could be better because the knowledge is just not out there. So let's talk about this. When did you first get to the point where you said, something's wrong here and I better search for what the cause of it is?
Well, I think you hit a really interesting point right in your intro and saying that, you know, most people don't realize that, you know, there is such a deficiency in the provision of pre-hospital emergency care throughout the country, because thankfully, most people do not have to access the EMS system. And it ends up being what people kind of think of like as an insurance policy that, you know, oh, I know the area that I'm living in may have these services and, you know, hopefully I don't need them, or when I need them, it's because I'm very late in life. And most people, it's not a consideration. And I always contrast it against other areas where the state has a lot of involvement, such as, you know, the educational system, where it's on the forefront of most parents' minds for the better part of 20 plus years as they're raising their children. So of course, they're going to be involved in the governance of their local educational system. And of course, they're going to be aware of minute changes and the impact of regulatory changes on their children, because it's something they deal with on a day-to-day basis. So throughout my career, I think I started the way most people do, with, you know, bright-eyed and enthusiastic. You know, very quickly you realize some victories, you see where the system in your mind does work. You know, you're able to show up and provide life-saving measures. And over time, obviously, as you get to know the system better, that view becomes clouded with, you know, these gaping holes. And I think, you know, one of the first exposures to this I had, I was working for a hospital-based system in a fairly, you know, decent-sized city. And I would start to see that the majority of our clients statistically were the same people over and over again, who a lot of times were suffering from a combination of chronic mental health issues and chronic drug dependency. And, you know, we have a classic Pareto distribution here where, you know, a small number of people constitute the majority of the usage of the system, or a tragedy of the commons where, because people are not directly paying for this service, they will use it frequently. And I have to say, when I first heard of the tragedy of the commons, I'm sure it was in some Mises production somewhere, it immediately clicked. You know, I was probably in my early 20s when I first, you know, heard anything from the Mises Institute. And that one phrase, the tragedy of the commons, the light bulb clicked. I'm like, this is what we have in EMS.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, that's a great answer. So talk about, you sent me some briefing here, because as it turns out, I'm not an authority on this at all. But immediately, as the first two bullet points you sent me, I thought, I should have known. So first of all, let's talk about professional licensing, because wouldn't the average person think that, of course, you need that so that, you know, qualified people are in these positions?
Tom, I absolutely agree. There does need to be qualified people in these positions. I very much disagree that the state needs to be the group that is in charge of that. There's many, many other industries that I could draw parallels to where private organizations are the certifying bodies. And, you know, a good parallel is arboriculture. You know, the people that prune trees, state of Connecticut has a license for it, and it is not nearly as strict as the ISA certification. It's a private organization of other arborists who set the standards, and that test, from what I understand, my friends at arboriculture, is much harder and much more prestigious to be an ISA certified arborist. So the problem with having the state regulate professional licensing, a couple things that come to the surface right away. One is this obsession with enforcing a monoculture. And you're right, it sounds good. We want standards. We don't want this mishmash system where everyone's kind of doing their own thing. It speaks to a certain part of our thoughts about this to just say, oh, we want everything to be the same. The problem is if the standards are low, we have everyone equally as bad. The other problem that I've experienced time and time again throughout my years in this field is how slow the standards are to change, both the educational standards and the actual scope of practice, you know, the skills that we're allowed to do, you know. And I back to some of the work from the Mises Institute, I remember listening to a presentation by Timothy Turrell, where he was talking about how slow the FDA is to roll out, you know, new medications. And, you know, you can go back and do types of calculations to figure out how many lives were lost. In my recent history in this field, I'll give an example. There is a medication called Lasix. It's a diuretic. It's given to patients with congestive heart failure and fluid in their lungs. And there was a paper that came out in 2006 basically saying that this is an inappropriate drug for EMS providers to give, that it really should be given by a doctor at a hospital when they have more data available about the patient. They have lab values, they have x-rays, for example. And not only was it difficult for EMS providers to properly diagnose pulmonary edema, the condition you would give this drug for in the field without all of those advanced diagnostics, they actually figured out that there was a pretty high percentage of patients that were actually caused harm by inappropriately getting this drug. Now, that paper was published in 2006. You think, you know, what's a reasonable amount of time for it to be peer reviewed and for, you know, the standards to change? And, you know, I'll tell you that the statewide protocols for Connecticut didn't change in regards to Lasix until 2015. So you had better part of 9 years where this medication was in the protocol and where assumingly providers were continuing to give it without it changing. And of course, you can imagine, you know, the process to change the scope of practice is incredibly bureaucratic. And in the recent episode that, you know, really showed just how painful this bureaucratic process is all of the changes that pre-hospital care needed to make to accommodate COVID. You know, can imagine you have to quickly change your protocols and you see, you know, the state level people scrambling to committee hearings. And, you know, again, usually we were changing our practice at least several weeks ahead of the, you know, necessarily some official guidance coming out.
As I look at your points you sent me, a couple of things stand out that remind me of something else in healthcare that I think they're called certificates of need. I forget if yeah. The C stands for certificate or not, where if you're going to build another hospital, it's something like the other facilities in the area have to agree that there's a need for one or something like that. And of course, yes. In no other field would we say that. We're not going to ask, you know, some shoe store if they think there's a need for another shoe store in the area. So you've written, first of all, geographical monopoly privileges in Connecticut, which is where you are given to primary service area holders. This license must be issued by the state, and any attempt to expand your service requires the approval of other services in the area. And then what you've just talked about with this scope of practice, if you want to offer some new kind of treatment, evidence-based service or treatment, you'd be prohibited from doing so unless you get the state to approve it for all your competitors as well. So, I mean, like, what the heck is going on? So, first of all, what is the state doing in the first place, telling any of you or your competitors, which presumably you want to have a good reputation, presumably you want people to survive. You're not going to introduce some new practice for the purpose of killing them, you would assume.
Absolutely. And again, it comes back to this obsession with a monoculture and, you know, wanting everything to be the standard and same. across the board. Now, again, if you look back at a little bit of the history of how EMS evolved, again, I think this kind of follows along the lines of Robert Higgs's thesis about, you know, there's a crisis that happens and the state ramps up its power and then it never comes back down to baseline, which is effectively what happened. So in the 1960s, there was a paper that came out on the accidental death and disability in the United States. And basically it exposed or called attention to the fact that there was no unified trauma system in the United States. And trauma outcomes varied significantly geographically. So if you lived out in the boonies, you know, and you got in a car accident, your chance of dying was much higher than if you lived in a city. Now, for all of us, you know, common folk, that makes complete sense. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's one of the decisions that we make when we decide to live in a rural area. There's a lot of pros to living in a rural area. There's a lot of cons, one of being which that you're far from a hospital. So anyway, so the big national outroar, right? And politicians do what they do. They capitalize on it. And there are Senate hearings and bills and that kind of thing. But effectively, several of the acts they passed charged each state with establishing an Office of Emergency Medical Services. And one of their charges was to create these PSAs. Now, if you look at the intent and what I think was the intent in the 70s, the idea with creating primary service areas was not to set a cap or create a monopoly. I think the intent was to make sure that these underserved areas, someone in government was responsible, because basically what they were doing, the state was saying, hey, you're a rural town. You don't have anyone in charge of EMS there. We're going to require you to put someone in charge. So, you know, they were charging the municipalities for doing that. Well, obviously, you know, on the surface, we're like, yeah, it's good. We want trauma services, especially in these underserved areas. However, what that turned into in many states is exactly what you were just talking about, is now if you wanted to just start an ambulance service, you know, they have crazy capital requirements. You have to have a certain amount of money in the bank, crazy amounts of insurance, and you need to petition all the surrounding towns and they can go to a hearing and basically block you from starting a service. And it's worse than that. Even existing services, when they want to add an extra ambulance, you know, perhaps they've decided that, you know, because of population growth or the changing demands of their town, they want to put on another ambulance, you still have to apply to the state. And it's a multi-month process. So, you know, Austrians talk about monopoly conceptually. And then, you know, this is just one of those examples of how it's actually created and endorsed by the state.
There's one particular problem here that I don't know how you deal with, because there's something, of course, unique about healthcare services. And that is that they genuinely are life and death. Now, I suppose food is also life and death. I mean, we could extend this, but generally people are not, when they go to the grocery store, they're not on the verge of starvation. You know, death is not immediately pressing upon them. But when they call an ambulance, they may well be. So it's very hard, it seems to me, to be able to limit access to ambulance services, because you would think individuals themselves would be the best judge of whether they're in some kind of health danger. But the problem, as you said at the beginning, is that there is a tragedy of the commons here. And we have a case, you've said that there are cases of people who call over 100 times a year.
Yes.
Because the service is quote unquote free. So what's the net result of that? Just makes the cost go up for everybody else. What's the exact result of that?
There's a cascade of results. I mean, just start with provider fatigue, right? We signed up to do this job for noble reasons, most of us. And, you know, we know the capability we possess. You know, literally, you do EMS for any period of time. And you could see an example. You know, EpiPens are a great example. EpiPens are a life-saving treatment. When that ambulance rushes lights and sirens to your house and gives you an EpiPen, absolutely a difference between life and death. So, you know, we contrast that with people who, you know, are not compliant on their medications, for example, their psychiatric medications, or, you know, are dealing with addiction issues and, you know, will literally call and say, I want to be brought to the hospital. Now, again, we're legally required to bring people to the hospital. Now, where does that come from? Well, you know, kind of rewind to EMS history a little bit. In the 80s, there was a phenomenon that the systems were struggling with called patient dumping. You know, hospitals ran, in most cities, the hospitals were running the ambulances, and effectively they would look at, you know, did you have the ability to pay? Oh, no, you don't. We'll bring you to the charitable hospital across town. We're only going to bring the good payers to our hospital. You know, so, you know, that kind of legislation, again, spurred into not just dealing with the problem of hospital dumping, it ended up creating this situation where people know that they can just call us and get transportation. And there's, you know, a lot of misconceptions. In most systems, people believe if you call the ambulance, you'll get seen faster. Maybe years ago, that was the case. in recently, you know, certainly post-COVID, that's really not the case. We routinely bring patients in on the ambulance. The nurse takes one look at them and looks at our vitals and says, oh, to the waiting room for you. And you're, you know, waiting like just as if someone had driven you. But yeah, so it's very fatiguing to have these repeat customers. And the other problem it creates is you're tying up resources. If you looked at EMS like the country club example or the Disney World example, and I think this is an interesting thought exercise that libertarians engage in a lot. Just if we're trying to go down the road of imagining, you know, how the system might be provided in the absence of an overbearing state, you know, in a geographic area, if you all paid, you know, you were staying at Disney World, we're all paying as part of our registration fees there, the expectation that if I fall down and break my leg, that someone will show up and take care of it. So, you know, to an extent, as a civilian in an affluent Connecticut town, you know, one of the things you expect for your taxes, and we know that, you know, it's not the same as a country club or that kind of thing, but in most people's minds, they're paying for that service to be available. What is not true, though, is there's frequently cases where that one ambulance that is required in your town, because you're the PSA holder, you have to have one ambulance on, is busy taking care of people that, you know, do not necessarily require an ambulance to go to the hospital. And, you know, the last thing I'll say is it gets into some ethical dilemmas too, because if you look at the ethical doctrines that try to guide our care as healthcare providers, and you really look at patient advocacy as something that we're all supposed to be doing. And, you know, we ask ourselves the question, what's in the best interest of the patient? Well, increasingly asking ourselves the question, you know, is it in the best interest of this patient to be transported to the hospital? You know, especially during the peaks of COVID, it's very hard to not answer no to that. And that creates a dilemma for us because we have a legal responsibility. We're charged by law to transport someone, but we also know we're bringing them to a facility that's overrun, that they're just going to go to the waiting room. They're going to potentially risk being, if they don't already have COVID, they're going to be around a bunch of people who do and risk some exposure there. So, you know, it really is starting to wear on us that it's creating this ethical dilemma for us. And, you know, that's fatiguing and it's probably one of the drivers that's driving people away from this field.
It's just incredible. I had just had absolutely no idea. But on the other hand, what exactly would you prefer to happen in the case of somebody who just abuses the ambulance system? Because, you know, what if it could be the boy who cried wolf? Let's say the person is genuinely a hypochondriac. But then that one day that you get on the phone and say, look, you're not going to be tying up our resources anymore, that's when the person dies.
Right. Yeah. So again, that's why we have to respond. And, you know, that is the, I mean, straight up fear mongering that goes on. So certainly anyone at any time can succumb to an acute illness, right? We're all at risk of it. The older we get, the more comorbidities we have, the more likely it is that this is the time that it's something serious. However, the system has better ways of dealing with people that have chronic illness, you know, and that's visiting nurses, that's inpatient programs, that's, you know, involving the patients and families to make better, you know, management plans and care plans. We don't have training in that as EMS. Our training is primarily life-saving interventions. Someone stops breathing, someone's choking, someone cuts their leg off. We can handle that. We're trained to do that. And we have all the evidence to show that in those cases, if you quickly get a provider to that patient's side, you can provide life-saving care. So the other issue that this creates is if you look at EMS, or let's just say, let's look at a country with a single-payer healthcare system. If you look at it in your mind as, I don't need to worry about that, could that impact your behavior? And that's always something we wonder, right? Like if you have insurance, or do you act in a more risky way? I don't know the answer to that, but maybe that's something game theory looks at. But the other way it impacts behavior is if you live in a town where you know you have, or you think you have an ambulance available, how much individual training or care do you take in the two aspects of out-of-hospital care that you need to know? One is recognition of serious conditions, and the other is the initial treatment. So what ends up happening here is we have a populace who thinks, well, I have first responders that are going to respond. And you know, depending on where you live, there can be a large variation in who and what shows up. But we hope that they at least meet the minimum standards. So when you think that, oh, you know, the trained responders are going to show up, how much do people really learn on their own about caring for their own conditions? How active are they in making judgments about what the best place to go is? A perfect example I'll give you is you have someone with a chronic shoulder condition where it becomes dislocated. And this patient They have an injury. It gets dislocated from time to time. They need to be brought somewhere, right? They can't get it back in on their own. You could bring them to an emergency department and incur upwards of a $1,300 ambulance bill and then incur, you know, thousands of dollars of hospital bills. Or that patient could be brought to their orthopedist who maybe has a clinic down the road. The problem is they dislocated their shoulder and they can't drive. So in that case, you have these examples where there's so many other ways you could handle either people with chronic conditions or people with just subacute injuries or subacute illness that they could go to these alternate facilities. These are patients that maybe just truly need transport. You know, this guy's dislocated his shoulder a bunch of times. Like, hey, just my orthopedist is 5 minutes down the road. I just can't drive safely. You know, can you get me down there? So, you know, the current system can't address that. It is a one-size-fits-all solution that was innovative in 1970. And it just hasn't innovated past that. Like, again, you look at the design of school buses or the way the post office runs, or the airline industry, for that example. All these, you know, GSEs, they look the same for a long period of time. And maybe they were flashy and innovative when they first started, but they don't keep up with innovation.
Hey folks, quick message from Moll Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. You're saying at one point that pay and working conditions not being where they should be helps to account for a lot of the turnover and difficulty in staffing here. But whose fault is that? I don't understand. What's the source of that problem?
So this is where my heart goes out to my colleagues and my peers, because they know something's wrong, right? They're feeling it. And, you know, maybe they can't quantify exactly what the issue is with wages or where the disparity is. And I could throw some numbers around because I have a rough idea where they fall, but they definitely do not, you know, can't even conceptualize the source of the issue. So, you know, for example, in 2005, when I first started in EMS, I was making $12.50 an hour as an EMT. And this was at a time when the federal minimum wage was, you know, about $5 an hour. You're making 2.5 times the federal minimum wage. And as someone who had just come out of high school, to find a job where I could take a 120-hour course and, you know, make 2.5 times minimum wage, I thought that was pretty good. But actually, one of the things that influenced me to not go to college, you know, my friends were going into debt to go to school, and I was making, you know, 2.5 times what most of them were making and, you know, working like 60 hours a week. So it was good money then. And the problem is now that same EMT makes about $18 an hour when the Connecticut minimum wage is, you know, 14, it's going to be $15 an hour next year. So you went from a position that paid way over what most marginal workers were making to one where you're considered a marginal worker. I mean, this is right up there with what a lot of these other entry-level jobs, and not to disparage them, but grocery stores and whatnot are paying the same thing. So, you know, as far as what the cause is, a couple of things come to mind. One is the way, and this is my understanding of it, one of the ways workers can make more money is to add technology and capital to their field. You know, if you're a landscaper, do you want to have shovels in a wheelbarrow or, you know, a backhoe and a, you know, lawnmower? As soon as you give technological equipment to workers, they can make more money. Well, we're not being allowed to advance past, you know, where we're at today. We're very slow to advance. There's very little incentive for, you know, governments to invest money in changing EMS. You know, they're kind of incentivized to maintain the status quo. And, you know, right to the calculation problem, when you're running a socialist medical system, how do you even calculate the benefit of adding, you know, more technology to, you know, improve everyone's productivity? So I think that's one of the main causes of the stagnation is, you know, that we're not able to adopt technology. there's so many other things we could be doing. I could spend a whole episode just talking about the ways that we could offer different services and bring more money in. And then also, there's a complete disconnect between prices and wages. Meaning, if I'm working producing TVs or something like that, and I'm working at a factory, I know what the product that I'm making costs. I know how much people are willing to pay for it. And I also have a lot of insight into where that industry is going. You know, I know, you know, TVs get cheaper every year, you know, computers get cheaper every year. And in that sense, in those sectors of the economy, people are kind of out innovating the rate of inflation. So that's the other half of it. I mean, obviously, you know, there's inflation on top of that. So everybody's dealing with inflation, and, you know, marginal workers, which EMS workers mostly are now, are, you know, the most affected by inflation. And, you know, again, most people in society have no idea the actual cause of inflation.
Well, you could say that again. Well, speaking of that, you also pointed out that insurance reimbursement hasn't been keeping up with inflation. And that, again, at least I don't know how this works in other states, but the rates in Connecticut are fixed by the state.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard to imagine that there are people who think that we have a Wild West, laissez-faire, free market healthcare system. I don't know how the thing stays going with all this.
It's not going to stay going much longer. I mean, you know, mark this down. I'm watching the trend lines, right? I'm watching the average number of years of experience of one of my current providers crashing, I'm watching the total number of applicants crashing, I'm watching the turnover, you know, accelerate, you know, and above and beyond the aggregate data, because there's plenty of reasons to be suspicious of aggregate data. Anecdotally, right? I have a number of people who started off, you know, working as EMTs for me, who I think would have been great paramedics. You know, paramedic is the next step after EMT. These are where the advanced care providers, we provide medications and stuff like that. A lot of people who would make great paramedics going, you know what, I'm going to go on to be a diesel mechanic or a plumber or electrician and pick a field where there's a lot of opportunity for growth and one that isn't just fraught with so much, you know, restriction. But when you really start looking at, you know, we have control of the supply, you know, very tight supply of pre-hospital services, not even just ambulances. And, you know, we have fixed prices. I mean, this is a Soviet system that we're using, right? Is that a fair parallel?
In some ways it is. I mean, you're forbidden to innovate. You can only do certain things. You have to take the patient to a particular kind of place. You can't take them to a doctor's office or a clinic. You can't. So no wonder the technology goes back to 1970 and hasn't improved since then. I mean, honestly, when we think of the Soviet Union, it was not exactly a technological powerhouse.
No, and when you're starting with the premise that labor adds value and, you know, that you mix your labor, you know, it's when you value people working, and obviously there's a lot of unions, you know, involved in EMS care. So, you know, think about the motivation of union is more people, more people, more people. And, you know, they don't see the bigger picture there that that's actually counterproductive to wages is, you know, they're like, keep out the non-union people and, you know, make sure that it's just their group that's getting to work. So, you know, there's that impact as well.
So what would be your reform of the system? I mean, obviously, would it just be remove state involvement? And if you did do that, what would the market for these services look like?
So I think that, you know, consumers are really suffering from the lack of choices. I do think there is a place for a service that is available for the worst case scenario, but we have really solid data that says of all the ambulance calls we're going on right now, that's about 3% of our cases are examples of a civilian in an immediate medical or traumatic event that needs an ambulance right then and there. So the rest of that volume should be handled in a variety of other ways. And what it really does is it just gives more choice to the consumer. You know, my anecdote about the guy with the shoulder dislocation, you know, could he have been better served if an orthopedist was allowed to drive to his house? Or not even an orthopedist. What if an orthopedist was allowed to send a paramedic who had orthopedic training? And we could do telemedicine. We could do facilitated telemedicine. You know, that's a major area of innovation that we should tap into that we can't. So there's a problem with telemedicine. And it's that the people that would benefit from telemedicine are people with chronic illness and who are homebound. Well, unfortunately, those patients tend to be less tech savvy. So they're exactly the patient that would benefit the most from having access to telemedicine, but they really need help facilitating the technological part of that. But, you know, it's effectively illegal for a paramedic or an ENT to go to someone's house and help them do telemedicine, turn on the iPad, maybe check some blood pressure for them, do a medication count. All of those different things you know, are things we could be doing that we're prohibited from doing. And, you know, I love to admit here, whenever I see Robert Murphy talk about, you know, he gets asked all the time, you know, private provision of security, he always gives that caveat that we don't necessarily know what it would look like. That's up to the entrepreneurs and ultimately the market to decide what it would look like. I just know, you know, there's a lot of these little areas that could quickly innovate. And, you know, I have to say one of the most promising parallels that I've seen in probably the last decade is Uber and, you know, how they were able to disrupt the transportation industry. And maybe this is a lesson for those of us still working in the system that Uber changed the transportation industry by going outside of it, you know, and effectively, you know, finding, I guess it's a loophole, you know, say we're a ride sharing service. This isn't a livery service. So we don't have to apply by the livery standards. We don't need to get taxi medallions and that, you know, monopoly that, you know, the city is known for. So, you know, back to being real world libertarians, you know, how can we affect change now? And the constant question of what must be done. I would love for there to be drastic deregulation, but I think realistically, you know, as we're seeing now with, you know, DeFi and Bitcoin and all that, I think you'll just start to see alternate pathways. Once the public gets wise that, you know, the level of service available in their community is maybe not what it could be, and that some alternatives pop up, I think that's the way they'll go. And along those lines, if I could give just one more interesting anecdote that kind of just really sums all this up. So I have served on a couple of state committees here, and in particular, I was in a meeting about 2 years ago now, the committee that is supposed to be addressing the question of what's called community paramedicine. And community paramedicine is the state wants to start allowing paramedics to do things like treat and release. And they have whole committees looking into this question of, can we do this? How do we do it? What do we offer? And rather than just like saying, hey, you guys go develop programs in your community that best fit your community, the state needs to have a board and they got to appoint someone and have a law and create this whole bureaucracy that basically says, hey, paramedics can do things other than transport people to the hospital. Well, I'm in this committee meeting and someone goes, hey, has everyone seen that there's this company that is driving around to people's houses and taking care of them in their house? And they're called Dispatch Health and they're in Connecticut. And the outrage, right, from everyone on this committee is like, they can't do that. They need to be licensed by EMS. We're going to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, right up to the, you know, a very high person at the state is saying, oh, we're going to investigate this. Well, they come back to the next monthly meeting and they go, well, yes, they're hiring EMTs and paramedics, but they're not an EMS agency. They're not providing transport. We have no ability to regulate them. They're actually, you know, a mobile primary care practice. So, you know, already there are companies like Dispatch Health that are trying to, you know, crack into this area. And they're doing so by going in through channels that are outside of the current regulatory environment. But we know, you know, as we're starting to see a lot of areas starting to crack down on Uber, I'm sure it won't be long before, you know, rather than trying to do what's best for society, we're going to just see legislative focus shift to, oh, we got to regulate this next person that's trying to, you know, get in on our monopoly.
And yet that's obviously a service people would benefit from. And that's a service we used to have. I mean, right? Doctors used to do house calls. This was not out of the ordinary. And now all of a sudden, there's no innovation allowed. And how could this possibly be said with a straight face to being done in the interests of the patient or the consumer, right? It's obviously for the cartel.
Exactly. And you know, the hospitals, the other thing we're seeing in the state of Connecticut is there just continues to be consolidation of hospital networks. And again, you asked me the question, you know, what would you do if you could repeal one piece of regulation? Very high on my list is in Connecticut, I would remove the requirement that we have to be overseen by a hospital-based physician. Essentially, in order for me to practice as a paramedic in Connecticut, I have to be working for a service that owns a PSA. So I can't just freelance as a paramedic. I can't go out and, you know, you can't call me up and say, hey, I'm at my hotel. My kid just bumped their head. Can you check them out for me? Illegal. I cannot do that. That's practicing without a license. That's prohibited. So I have to be involved in a service. I have to be in my PSA. So again, if I'm not in my primary service area, I couldn't just like go over to the next town and help someone. I can help them, but I'm acting more as a civilian than really in my professional capacity. Then I also need to get permission from the local hospital. And that's usually the one that's geographically the closest. Now, some of the more remote parts of the state, there is one hospital And even if there's three or four of them, you know, I think of like Northwestern Connecticut, there's only one big company that owns all the hospitals in that area. So I have to get permission from that doctor. And that doctor actually has a lot of influence on, you know, what I'm allowed to do, because even as much as the state sets a scope of practice, the local doctor can actually decrease that. So the state says you can carry medications other than opiates for pain management. This was going for years. We were only able to carry opiates. So if you hurt your leg, I could only give you morphine or fentanyl, you know, this drug that we know is highly addictive, and that I wasn't allowed to carry Advil and Tylenol. You know, finally the state says, oh, we're going to add that in the scope of practice. You know, I can finally allow, you're allowed to give out medication that's available over the counter. So the local medical control could basically stop that or say, well, you know, we need to train you on how to give it ibuprofen. So, you know, it's going to be 6 months or 2 years until that's rolled out. So if I could repeal one piece of the regulation, it would be to allow us to go out and hire our own medical director. I think as individual providers, the testimony that we can give in favor of a more diverse system really comes down to the fact that as I've worked in different communities throughout my life, communities are not a monoculture and their needs are not equal. The needs of a rural community when it comes to pre-hospital care is completely different than an urban environment. And I'd rather be able to hire a medical director from my community. Maybe it's a doctor that lives in that town that understands, you know, the needs. You know, a good example is opiate risk reduction. It's a big issue across the whole country, right? And paramedics deal with the brunt of it. We deal with the overdoses, you know, fatal and otherwise. And in, you know, there's been some pilot programs throughout the country where paramedics arrive at an overdose, they revive the person, and they do two things. They provide counseling. There's a, you know, three bullet points about counseling, and then they give them Narcan. They give them the antidote and they leave it there. And in these studies, these counties were able to demonstrate a 50% reduction in death during the course of the study. If paramedics were allowed to counsel people about opiate overdoses and also to give out Narcan, you cannot do that in Connecticut. It is illegal. We want to do that. And again, just imagine our frustration, because we're the ones that bear the emotional side of this. We're the ones seeing the overdose, and we're seeing someone that's actually struggling with opiate addiction. And we see their ups and downs. We see that they've been good for a while and they got into a program and then they had a relapse and we're there again. And, you know, we're the ones that have to interact with them on a highly personal level in their home and all that. So, you know, it's just another example of if we had our own physician in our own town that knew we were having an opiate issue in that town, we went to him and said, hey, doc, we want to be able to give out Narcan. Here's how we're going to run the program. Here's the studies that show it works. Here's how we're going to provide oversight. Like, can we do that? You know, because it starts to get into this sticky spot where, you know, what are the incentives of a physician at a hospital that's five towns away to let you do more things? Their answer is, nope, just bring them to the hospital and we'll deal with them.
Yeah, what can you say? Well, are you at risk of getting in any kind of trouble professionally by talking like this?
I mean, there's always the possibility, but...
I mean, too late now, you know.
Yeah, no,
I just thought I would ask.
No, I've thought about it. I've definitely thought about it. And I haven't, you know, I've spoken on podcasts usually about clinical topics, not about system issues, but, you know, it's like... The people that kind of inspired me to speak out about this, like as silly as this sounds, I'm a big listener of Joe Rogan. And at one point, you know, he kind of talked about saying that he has, you know, it's an expletive, but FU money. And yeah, I don't have that kind of money. Like, let's just set that out there right off the bat. But I'm established enough in my life now that if I had to stop being a paramedic tomorrow, my family's not going to starve. And, you know, this system is going to come crashing down, whether I call attention to it or not. You know, my thoughts now are really with my peers who are struggling to provide quality care and dealing with the emotional burden of the system that's failing the people that we have to take care of. You know, at the same time, the fact that they're increasingly becoming marginal workers and, you know, they're having trouble making ends meet because of all the economic forces at play here. So yeah, if this gets me in trouble, then so be it. You know, I've had to accept that at a certain point.
Well, Nick, I appreciate your insights on this, on a topic I dare say no other libertarian podcaster has hit. Nobody wants to touch that ambulance issue, but I think it's because nobody knows about it. As I said at the beginning, nobody knows about it. And I'm glad you wrote to me, and I'm glad we covered it, because I wanted to hit the ambulance question by 2,200 episodes, and mission accomplished. But all the different factors here, all the different ways the market is distorted, I would never have thought of them. I really wouldn't. Other than the anybody can call the service for free. I knew that had to be a problem. But other than that, all these other factors, and they all point back to the state, that's very important for people to be aware of. So I appreciate you letting us know about it. Thank you, Nick.
Awesome.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for another week of the Tom Woods Show. I have coming up, and we'll be making an announcement about, in the next couple of weeks, a brand new free ebook. Yes, that's right. And this one is called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences. And if you keep on listening to the Tom Woods Show, I will let you know where you can get that thing, cost you nothing, and will blow your mind with all kinds of fresh and original and important and timely ideas. So watch for that, everybody. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.